two halves to every whole, and that's certainly true of my upbringing. And you've heard me maybe talk a bit at times about the difficulties of having an alcoholic father. For me, it was you're just never good enough.
Yeah.
I was never hugged. He never sat me on his lap. He never told me I was pretty or clever, or it was just never good enough. And I could score four goals and miss one, and I'd be an idiot in front of everybody, you know.
Welcome to Checks and Balances. I'm Michael Vincent. This is James Blair. And today we've got an extra special guest, Naomi Ballantyne, founder of multiple insurance companies in New Zealand, and the first woman in New Zealand to sell a company for $1 billion.
Naomi, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks.
And also, thanks for sponsoring us.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Yeah. So thank you very much for coming along. So for those that don't know Naomi, you're going to get a lot out of today because your track record, I would say, in New Zealand is probably more people should know what you've done, and there's a hell of a lot that we can learn from you.
Thank you.
So the question is, where do we start? And I think we should probably start at the beginning, because what you've built, so for those that don't know, Naomi has founded two insurance companies and sold them. The second one was for a cheeky billion, right?
Yeah, chump change.
Yeah. It's nice to hit that, get that extra zero on the end, isn't it? And then she was also the first employee for Sovereign when that was getting started as well. So you've been around the insurance game for a long time. You've seen companies go from absolutely nothing to these big behemoths, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I say now at this end of my career, I'm the market constant. I'm everybody's I've just always been there for everyone's career for the whole of their time in the life insurance industry. And someone described it as being everyone's mum. So whether, you know, people still work for me or they used to, just about everyone has worked for me at some point in along those careers, and I've watched their careers blossom, or they've been advisors in businesses that I've run. So everybody's been in my sphere, and I guess I do feel like everyone's mum.
Yeah, that's deep, Naomi, because if you've always been the constant, that's about to change, right?
It is.
Yeah, so you'll be scaring a lot of people with that.
Change is scary for a lot of people. Yeah. But you know, I feel like I've done my thing, and if that's benefited people, I'm really happy that it has. But it is time for me not to be worried about anyone else ever again.
So let's. I think it would be a good place to start is maybe talk a little bit about your upbringing, because the risks you've had to take, the skills you've had to build, the challenges that you've had to overcome. Tell us a little bit about your upbringing and how it, you know, impacted what you've done.
I think there are two halves to every whole, and that's certainly true of my upbringing. And you've heard me maybe talk a bit at times about the difficulties of having an alcoholic father. And his kind of girl parenting, and he probably did it to the boys too, but I think for me it was you're just never good enough.
Yeah.
I was never hugged. He never sat me on his lap. He never told me I was pretty or clever, or it was just never good enough. So it didn't matter what I did. You know, I'm an Auckland champion sprinter, but if I came second, I failed. You know, I played hockey at top level, and Dad would stand on the sideline, and I could score four goals and miss one, and I'd be an idiot in front of everybody. Wow. You know, schooling, it was never good enough. I was a very good student, and I, you know, so it was just never good enough, and it hurt, and I didn't know why he was saying those things to me. Mm. But the advantage I had, I guess, was being smart enough to go, but you can't be right. Look at all these things that I'm achieving, and other people, school and everybody else telling me that I'm doing good. Like, the things you're saying, they just can't be true. I don't know why you're saying them to me, and it hurts, but it can't be true. And I guess the advantage of that is, if your father's words don't break you, nobody else is ever going to be able to either with the things that they say. And that certainly stood me in good stead along the way. But the other half of that was my mother, who I call love on a stick, right? She was Pacific Islander, came to New Zealand, very poor, not a lot of opportunity for schooling, heavy accent, a lot of racism in New Zealand at the time. But she was just love on a stick. And mum did everything.
Yeah.
Dad's alcoholic. She couldn't drive. We walked everywhere. She walked to every sports event that we had. We all walked with her, but she took five kids to everything, walked to the beach so we could have a beach, you know, spend every minute that she could, making sure that we had the best life. For sprinting, when the neighbours were out, they had a flat lawn. We didn't. So mum would jump over the fence whenever they were out, sit there for an hour with me, on your marks, get set, go.
Yeah.
Practicing starts. You know, stuff like she could cook like a dream.
Yeah.
She cut the lawns with a machete. She painted the house. What she proved to me is not just that girls could do anything, but should.
Mm.
That you don't need to rely on a man or a husband or anyone else. That if something needs doing, you got two arms, two legs and a brain, figure just it out. It wasn't that she said it, it's that she showed it. So I feel very lucky to have the resilience that I have and the ability to not think I can't do anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that kind of, perhaps shows in some of the decisions you've made throughout your career where other people potentially would, you know, just be like, oh, you know what, I'll go with the flow here and get a job and, you know, I've got the security of this role and I'll shift companies. But actually there are points there where you sort of thought, I don't agree with this. I'm going to go do my own thing.
Yeah. I'm an accidental entrepreneur.
Yeah.
So I guess it depends on what you call an entrepreneur, right? But starting at Sovereign, I didn't know I was going to be an entrepreneur. I don't know what a startup business does. I'm 24. You know, what is that, right? But you get thrown into the deep end.
Yeah.
You're it. They want you to build this company. And these are two people who'd been in big jobs at other companies where they hadn't built things.
Mm.
You know, they'd managed things. And so you're it. And in the absence of no one in the industry having done it before, you have to make it up as you go along. And what you got to be brave enough to do that. And then you've got to research stuff. You've got to be curious enough to figure out, is there a law that I'm not allowed to do this? Because if there isn't, I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And then I guess brave enough to go, oh, that sucked. What I did then, that didn't work. Yeah. So I should do something different, change it. And so if that's entrepreneurship, I learned that at Sovereign.
Yeah.
Because I had to. But then once you realize that most people don't know why they're doing something, they're doing it because the last person did it, which makes it impossible to do it better because you don't even know why you're doing it, right? So once you learn that, it's very hard to go back to just doing something because someone else said you should.
Yeah.
Because it's the way it's always been, because now you never want to do that ever again.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something to be said for the deep end, you know?
Yeah.
Like just getting put in there and being like, it's sink or swim. You've got the tools to sort this out, or you need to make the tools to sort this out. Go get it.
Yeah.
Although I would say that with Sovereign, no one else applied for the job. So all the people in the industry who could have had that opportunity wouldn't. And so I think that there's an entrepreneurial spirit in me going, I'm 24, I've got a great job, but this is fun. This sounds like me.
Yeah.
You know, getting a chance to do something new. I had no idea what that was, but it was not the same thing as what I was already doing, right?
Yeah.
And yet nobody else saw that. So maybe it's always been in me. I don't know.
Yeah, well, you said something interesting about people just doing the role the same way the person beforehand has. And I know there's the quote about everything that exists, the way we know life, you know, the people who made it are not any smarter than us. But then it takes quite a bit of, you know, to move out of that autopilot to actually go, is there a better way to do this?
It takes bravery and persistence because a lot of people moan about the way their company does things. Just about everyone does.
Yeah. Like, we both worked at banks, so don't worry. Yeah.
Only I was running this place, I would do it this way. Don't they see that this is the right way to do it, but actually never go through the channels to actually make that change, right? So, or get stopped at the first hurdle because your boss said, go away.
Yeah.
That, don't challenge me.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and then you just get bitter and twisted, but you carry on and you carry on and you carry on, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that it takes a huge amount of bravery to go, this doesn't work. Here's what will work, and now I'm going to make sure that I make this happen, and risk that you're wrong, and other people taking great glee at telling you that you're wrong. Right?
Yeah.
I just want to jump back a step. So, like, starting at Sovereign, you did a marine biology degree.
I was in the middle of a marine biology course. Yeah.
Why did you move away from that and go into insurance?
I was really good at science and maths. I was the first person in the family to go to university. Dad, for all his problems, sort of, I guess, recognised that I was bright and he wanted me to go as far ahead as he could. He loved Jacques Cousteau on television. Like, that to him was opening up a world that he'd never had a chance to see or be part of. So it was his idea that I should do marine biology out I didn't have any idea. So I went, okay, went off to uni and did chemistry. You know, the yeah. start of a, because you start with bio and then yeah. you move into zoology and all the other stuff. So, but then I very quickly realised that it's like 12 years of a degree to get through the end of it. And there's a lot of marine biologists working for DOC for minimum wage, yeah. counting shellfish.
Mm.
That didn't look like Shaggy's time to me. And I wanted to get married, which was, you know, partly, you know, I met my husband very young. We went to the school ball together. But also it was a way of escaping a very difficult sort of family situation. And I couldn't afford to stay at university and get married. I was paying my own way.
Yeah.
I got an A bursary, but, you know, that wasn't enough. So I thought, no, I'm going to leave university and get a job. And management trainee insurance came up, and I had no idea what insurance was. We never talked about money. That our parents definitely never had insurance. Like, you know, what the heck is that? But management trainee sounded like a plan. So I applied for it and got it, and it happened to be in a life insurance company. The rest, as they say, is history. I just fell in love with it.
Right, okay. And for a lot watching, there we go, falling in love with life insurance. that's not an obvious one to me. Why do you have the passion for life insurance that you do?
Yeah, well, the industry was very, are you being served, you know, six floors up, the old guy that ran the business was there, and once a year the staff would traipse in front of him and he'd hand you out a bonus pay packet, and you're all doing very well, and, you know, you got up one step, one grade each year, you know, really old-fashioned, super frustrating, but that's the way it was. But what I figured out very early on is that we paid out money to people when bad things happened to them. In those days, it was pretty much life insurance, not any other type of benefit. And people would cry. But we just, you paid us to do this, right? And they realised that the thing that we did made massive difference in people's lives when it came to it. And also, you had every other aspect of a big business career. You go to marketing, claims, you know, all this options around your career. But fundamentally, the whole organization did that one thing, which was pay out money to people when really bad things happen, and it made a massive difference in their lives. And I've never found anything else that called me like that does.
Yeah. And I guess since you started in Sovereign and in the insurance industry to now, there must have been a lot of change in terms of the products and the processes and everything. What are some of the sort of the key changes that you've seen in the industry so far?
Well, I think in New Zealand there was a very definite split between investment and life insurance when we had the first GFC, I think, and people suddenly saw their life insurance cash values disappear, being eaten up by the cost of the risk insurance. And the advisors who sold it never understood that that could happen.
Yeah.
And they thought they were life insurance advisors selling whole of life and endowment and investment like unit link type products. They were selling life insurance. And what they found out is the clients thought they were selling them savings plans.
Yeah.
That would never go down. They didn't know how to handle it.
Yeah.
And they just ran away in droves. And that became the split between investment and life insurance. And we've never really had a coming together of product again like that. Certainly of advice, yes, because you need holistic advice, but not of the product trying to do both of those things. And we're still there in New Zealand. I actually think that's a good thing because you know what you're paying for on both sides of that fence. And if you need both, have both. But if you don't, right? Don't bundle the two together. So that's one massive change. The other massive change is we now have products that speak to specific things, income replacement, health insurance, you know, trauma insurance, things that do a lot more earlier in the lives of people than just life insurance did. And also New Zealand's extremely innovative in terms of leading the world in product design, et cetera. And I think I've played a part in that.
Yeah, cool.
And I love that. I love the impact on New Zealand that the competition and the innovation that those companies have brought to the market have brought to our competitors.
Mm.
So everybody's better as a result of that. And I'm chuffed at that as well.
Yeah. So the other thing I was thinking about when you're talking about what's changed is with Sovereign, obviously bought by a bank, and that was the transition of banks taking everything, and now they've gone the complete opposite way where they sold everything back off.
Yeah.
And I wonder how long it'll take before they go back the other way again.
Well, I think banks think they know everything to do with money.
Yeah.
And I think they thought life insurance was just another money transaction. And I don't think they realized or appreciated that heart. That you do good things at bad times.
Mm.
You don't just take a clip of money, but that money goes back, right? And you can't ever be accurate about when that money's going to go back. it's never going to be what you think it's going to be. Assumptions are the best guess you can based on the past, but the future doesn't behave like that. But you still can't make a decision that says no to a client because now your claims have gone over your expectations for you've got a promise to those clients. It's volatile and unpredictable, within the realms of, you know, the assumptions that you get to make and the data sets that you have. And so I think that short-termism, they thought they could apply to life insurance products. And it worked for a while because you flog a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But then conduct and culture comes up. And now you realize that actually if you make a promise 30 years from now, you've still got to deliver. Whether you like that product or not.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then conduct is also, and you can't lock a client in a product and never upgrade it ever again either because they have no choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you've got to bring them with you, no client left behind. All things that I have always believed in, but I'm not sure banks really understood the nature of the product. So it's not that they're bad people. They just thought it was like a bank account. Yeah. And then when they realized it wasn't, they realized, this is not our game. Yeah. Now they might come back, but hopefully in a different way with more understanding of the nature of that product. But it is a very different beast. It's a different beast from fire in general.
Yeah,
where you can cancel it because you don't like it. So you've only got 1 year's obligation to your customer, and then you can change what you sell them.
Yeah.
And not just price, but fundamentally the cover, whether you even give that customer cover or not. We can't do that. So even regulators, I think, didn't understand the long-term benefits of the way life insurance contracts are structured, but then also the risks of playing with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when's coming back to the sale of Sovereign, you decided not to stay?
I stayed for a while.
Right.
Yeah. And I think I was, fairly highly regarded. I was effectively in Hendry's 2IC when we sold to Sovereign. But I overheard a very senior person within the bank who went on to become even more senior talking about Sovereign staff as units. You need to get the cost of a unit down to match the cost of a unit in the bank.
Huh.
And at that moment I went, I'm not the right person for you and you're not the right organisation for me, so I resigned. I hadn't told anyone I was going to resign. My stomach just did this massive churn and I realised that I was fighting a losing fight because I don't own the business. They're a much bigger beast and clearly we're very successful, so believe what they were doing was successful, but I just, that was not something I could live with. And I couldn't stay there and let all the people that had come along from Sovereign believe that I was there, I was going to carry on running the business the way they were used to, because I couldn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't in my control. So I figured it was better that I just exited, and I didn't have a job to go to, and they didn't have pay me a cent to leave. But as a result, I didn't have a restraint of trade either.
Yeah. And I guess so once you've left Sovereign and you're out in the market, you're sort of thinking, okay, I don't have a job. I didn't get a golden handshake on the way out. What was sort of the catalyst for you saying, I'm going to start my own thing? And practically, how do you go to actually doing that?
Yeah. Well, I'd already done it.
Yeah.
At Sovereign.
Yeah.
Right. So there were a couple of things I didn't know how to do, but I thought I'd get another job in the industry. I thought, look at what I've done. Brokers love us. Products are good. Clearly I'm up the person who did, a lot of that. And no one would hire me because they were probably all men that I'd been, annoying for a lot of time. And now they had some power over me.
Yeah.
And I wanted to stay in New Zealand because my mother and father were here and our son was young and I didn't want to have to go to Australia or somewhere else to get a job. And so suddenly the reality hit that, gosh, Naomi, you're going to have to figure this out, either change industries or build something for yourself. Now, I knew practically how to build a life insurance company. I just didn't know where to get the money from.
Yeah.
And so the journey began learning that part of it because it's a lot of money for a life insurance company. You need a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah.
And where did you get the money from?
Well, we did a lot of things and we had a lot of doors closed in our face.
Yeah.
And especially comments like, yes, we know you're important, but you didn't build the company. Chris and Ian, the founders did. So, little girl, you were you were good, but you don't know how to do this kind of thing. So we went all over the place to Australia. I nearly ran out of money in the process. We nearly had to sell the house and go and get another job in another industry.
Yeah.
We reached that sort of rock bottom.
Mm.
But came across an investment company who were looking at the insurance industry, actually looking at buying a stake in an existing company and wanted to pick my brains about what, you know, I thought of the market, did a pitch to them about a startup life insurance company, had managed to convince the reinsurer that had supported Sovereign to be our reinsurer if I could get the funding. And they said yes. And that was Hallaby Holdings.
Yeah.
And so Club Life was born out of that.
Yeah. And then so you've put all this time in, you've left Sovereign, you've started this new thing, you've invested all this time to build it, and Club Life gets sold pretty quickly,
it
right?
It did. Yeah, because Hallaby's didn't believe me when I gave them a business plan that said this is how successful we'll be.
Yeah.
And it sucks up capital because you're paying out commissions for a long time. Mm. You don't become cash flow positive. And I think they had another probably banking analyst who didn't understand life insurance going, there's no way it's going to be that successful.
Yeah, guys, look at the and red then we just on this balance sheet here.
100%.
Yeah.
And so then they had to keep topping up the capital and we just got too rich for them too quickly.
Yeah.
And then they did the worst thing they could do and announced to the market that they were thinking about exiting. And then our competitors just went at us, right?
Yeah.
So every broker, every start a customer, you know, oh, they're not going to be here tomorrow.
Yeah.
So that's when we sold to ING. I found ING.
Yep.
As a buyer, I'd never had to do that before. Like, this is all new stuff, yeah. right? I'd never done any of this stuff before, but we got there, and incredibly grateful to ING for that. But it meant I lost control of my baby pretty quickly, and then invested every cent that I got out of it back into Partners Life. So people have always thought that I was rich because I started a business, right? But actually, every cent we've ever owned has either been in the house or the business. I've had a mortgage right up until when we sold Partners Life.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you need to A, own a big enough stake, B, no one else is going to invest in you if you don't invest in yourself. You know, so, you know, yes, on paper we were wealthy, but that's not the same thing.
Yeah. And I love that point you made before just around like you got to the bare bones at one point where you were thinking, well, we might have to sell the house here. Like we've really stuffed this up. And I think people kind of underestimate the amount of risk that people shoulder when they are building a business.
Was it just Club Life, right?
Yeah.
Because then when you start up Partners Life and you've got other people's money in it, then we've got a new regulator who's basically going, we're not going to give you a license because you guys are those roads and crooks that the competitors have told us about.
Yeah.
Because they know nothing.
Yeah.
They don't know anything about the industry. You've got everybody else's money now, your money and your reputation and, you know, on the line, and you have to figure out how to work around that pretty quickly too, which obviously we did.
Yeah.
But there's been lots of times when – and which is the comment I made about I don't want to be worried about other people anymore because I've been worried for our investors, for our staff, because a startup business always has risk.
Yeah.
And every change of regulation, new competitors come in, you know, all of those things, they're risk. COVID was a massive risk. You have no idea how many nights I spent going, this is the end of us.
Yeah.
Because we didn't know if all our clients were going to die, if all our staff were going to get sick, you know, was it going to be a run on? We knew nothing of that. But you have to hold it together for everybody else. So that's the comment that I made. I've done it for so many years now, since I was so young. There's nothing left in the tank for other people other than family.
With that, I don't know if burden's the right word, but that pressure, that responsibility, when the announcement did come out about the Partners Life sale, how did it, not the money, but how did it feel?
So I'll tell you a story. I long thought Dai-ichi Life was the best owner for Partners Life because they'd bought TAL in Australia 10 years earlier, and TAL went from number 8 to number 1.
Mm.
So what that demonstrated to me, and I knew the people from TAL and a number of the people from TAL, and they were allowed to run their own business.
Yeah.
So I looked at that and went, wow, that's amazing. They'd be the best owner. Blackstone were convinced that an IPO was the right answer, so we never approached Dai-ichi. And then they approached us. So magic is how I felt, that this is my dream outcome for the business. And how I felt was, it's not a startup company anymore. Even though it was big, it was still me and my shoulders and, you know, still investors waiting to get their money up, right, who'd come with us right at the start
and
got their money up, right? It was just a huge, huge sense of relief and happiness that Partners Life was now a forever company.
Yep.
Yeah, that the thing I built, whatever brand it ultimately ends up with in the future, that company is now a forever company. And the people who go to work for it are going to work for a company that's always been there rather than going to work for an entrepreneurial business with risk, right?
Yeah.
So What a relief, and what a blessing.
What about on the flip side of, like, so you've got the relief, but you have been the centerpiece, the one running the show for quite a long time, and now you are taking, I mean, at breakfast beforehand, you were talking about how, you know, the phasing into the background piece. That's would be a very hard thing for pretty much everybody to do.
It's an interesting, everybody says that to me, you can't do that, you can't retire, you'll be bored, you know, you can't not be the centre of attention. Well, two things you should know about me, I hate being the centre of attention. Yeah. So I do it, and I've put myself and my brand out there to give the company heart and soul and personality and culture from day one, because we're a brand new startup and you use what you've got, right? So you know, I'm the person dancing, you know, at every conference, the first person up dancing, I'm doing all the speaking. I do a whole lot of speaking around the country. But don't get me wrong, I love it, but I don't like being the centre of attention.
Yeah.
And so actually not being the centre of attention is me. It's normal. Me, and I've been this other person and got a lot of benefit from it,
yeah,
and enjoyed it for a long time. So that's one thing. And like I said, I've run at that level and been responsible for everybody and had the strength to do that for all those years. And I've reached a point where I can't anymore. I feel broken inside and I need to fix it. Mm. And graciously, Daiichi, who would have preferred that I stayed because of that profile, because there's risk there in me leaving this soon after the transaction. And they bought me, right? But they recognised that I need this. And so it's not hard. I do know that I need to be mentally challenged, but that's different. So being the person who has the ideas and can consult and give people and share those ideas, that's exciting to me. Being the person who has to make it happen and drag everybody with you, that's gone.
Yeah. Dragging yourself through the mud, scraping and clawing.
But man, when you're the face of the company, you're also the target.
Yeah.
So there's been so many interesting things said and written about me over the years. My son gets incensed, you can imagine.
Yeah.
Works in the business.
Yeah.
And every time I go, they don't matter. Mm. And it goes back to my dad couldn't do it to me. So I just don't read them. I don't engage with them. They're not important and they don't know me.
Yeah.
So what they say is not about me, it's about them.
Mm.
They're telling you a lot about them and nothing about me. And the people who know me know. So they're not convincing anyone who's important about those things. But my son he struggles with that so much because he loves me so much. And he sees me every day and he knows I'm not that person. So it is nice to have my son as my champion.
Yeah.
And all of my family, to be honest. But yeah.
And you've got some family sort of that were working in the business and still are. How have you managed that? And has that been a positive? I mean, there's challenges that come with that. How have you sort of navigated that?
Yeah, so we have all sorts of people's family, not just my family. So we have husbands, wives, sisters, aunties, uncles, you name it. We've got kids, parents, you name it. We've got it. We've never had a rule that says you can't. And you know, when you're a brand new startup business, you know, Peter Lasser, my brother, was founded it with me. Yeah, he's a technology, he's a fantastic technologist, he's the best, right? I like forget he's my brother. My son, who's worked for me his whole life at school, when he was going through school, he kept telling me he was never going to be in the insurance industry.
I love that.
He was doing it as a part-time job, but you know, he's worked for me his whole life. And people have always said it's nepotism. He's only there because he's magnificent.
Yeah.
He's magnificent. And now they see, you know, how magnificent he is. So my experience is my family members are better than everyone else, right? And they challenge me in a way that other people don't do. Trust me, if they think I'm being a dick, they tell me.
Yeah.
And I want to know because I don't want to be a dick, right? That's not my plan, right?
Yeah.
So if I'm wrong, if I'm glaringly wrong or someone thinks I'm wrong or they hear that people think I'm wrong, they tell me.
Yeah.
And it's out of love.
Yeah.
It might be brutal, but it's because they're family and they don't have to be nice to you. But it's but it's right, and I've relied on that my whole life.
Yeah.
So I think that by having family members, great people, bring great people, you get more great people. And certainly that has been true with all of the other people that are family in our lives. They don't bring people in that they think are going to screw over the company that they love.
Yeah.
They bring people in that they think are going to add to that, and then they hold them to account for that. And the upside is you've got more great people. And secondly, no one wants to let their family down.
Yeah.
We're a family. We're literally a family of 400 people.
Yeah.
No one wants to let their family down. It's really hard to leave your family, much harder than it is to leave a job.
Yeah.
So it works for us.
I love that point you make about, you know, because they're family, they can tell you when you're wrong, because there's nothing worse when everyone sits in a meeting like, yeah, great idea, amazing. Everyone walks out and like, that sucked.
Yeah.
And you're like, why didn't anyone just say it then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, it's just a positional thing.
Yeah.
And people who think you can be the boss and everyone's friend, you can be friendly with everyone, but you're always their boss in their mind.
Yeah.
So their behavior will always be different than it is with their friends and things. So you can get sucked into that as well.
Mm.
And it can cause you not to be able to do the hard things that you have to do to make a business work.
Yeah.
From time to time, you have to restructure. Sometimes people are not performing and they're in the wrong company or the wrong job at the wrong time for them, and they're dragging other people down. And you have to be able to do that, whether they're family members or somebody else's family member or not. So
is Christmas lunch awkward?
Yeah, you have
to. But you've got to do it.
Yeah.
And you can do it and be kind, but you still have to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, I mean, so we said right at the start, you know, the first woman in New Zealand to sell a company for $1 billion.
Well, to find it and sell it.
Yeah, find it and sell it. Important difference. Hopefully you're not the last. I'm sure you won't be the last. Before we move on, we talk all the time about planning and growing our wealth, but protecting that wealth is just as important. That's why having the right insurance in place can help when life goes unexpectedly.
And that's why this episode is brought to you by Partners Life, a New Zealand-operated award-winning insurance provider with over 300,000 Kiwis insured and 89% of claims paid.
Partners Life understand that having some insurance is better than having no insurance. They have flexible and personalized solutions for any budget or situation.
Check out their website in our show notes below.
What advice would you have, you know, piece of business advice that you would have for women who look at your story and go, that's very inspiring?
Yeah. So I've had lots of people say to me, I've always wanted to be an entrepreneur. I go, really? Have you got a plan? Like, do you know what it is that you're going to sell to the world and why anyone would pay for it? Why they would get it off you and not someone else? What's your difference? And how much money you think you're going to make? And how many staff you need? And where you're going to locate these premises? And who's going to fund it? And when they're going to get their money out? When you're going to get your money out? And they look at me like, no. But like, entrepreneur doesn't just like fall out of the sky, land in your lap. And if an opportunity does and you haven't done your work, you're going to fail, right? You're going to buy a business, maybe a big business, and turn it to a small one.
Yeah.
So it takes a huge amount of work to get to the point where you can sell to yourself that this is the right thing to do and I know how I'm going to make this happen, and sell it to others to get money into it. So like that's what – it's not a game. It's harder than working for someone else, and it will always be hard. And what you can guarantee is it will never work out the way you planned it to. But if you don't have a place to start and a direction to go, you don't have anything.
Yeah.
Don't have a business. So my advice to them was, if you truly want to do that, do it.
Yeah.
But it's going to take a lot of thinking before you ever get to the point where you can get out there and make it happen.
Yeah.
So start. And that's your hours at night and when the kids are asleep. And that's when you sit down and that's when you do it. And then you've got to be brave enough to go to someone and say, tear this apart, tell me what I've got wrong.
Yeah, and that's the tough bit, right? Because you can do all the planning in the background. And we sort of found it even with the podcast, right, at the start. You know, you make this thing and then you're like, you've got to show people. And you're like, oh God, I'm really putting myself out here. I'm being vulnerable, opening myself up for some pretty blunt words. But you need it.
And you want it.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So the interesting thing about asking people for feedback is if you get upset about the feedback they give you, they'll never give it to you again, right?
Yeah.
So you lose that gift of actually, you don't have to take their opinion, but you want it, right? Mm. So you understand what they say. That's exactly right. And like I said, the plan. Business never goes the way you plan it, just like life doesn't really.
Yeah.
You know, but you've got to be, if you never get momentum, you never go anywhere. The momentum is the key to everything. You can pivot. You can change direction completely if you want to. But if you never started, you would never know that was an opportunity available to you or that was a problem that you were going to encounter. So, and stop. Stopping at the first hurdle is also not entrepreneurship.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I said, you have to be willing to risk that it might fail, because lots of them do.
Yeah.
That is a real risk. It's not a paper risk. Oh, I know it's a risk, but it won't happen to me. It might.
Oh, yeah.
And it's okay. Right? So I always thought the worst that can happen to me is we have to sell everything and I have to go get a job. And I come from a poor family. You can be happy and poor.
Mm.
And I've got arms and legs and I'm healthy. I can make money.
Yeah.
Yeah, to live.
Think about it.
That's the worst that could happen. But the best that could happen is this.
Yeah.
Where I've landed. It's the absolute best outcome I could have ever wished for when I was a kid.
Yeah.
How lucky am I? But also, it happened because I was brave enough to take it.
Yeah, and there's a lot of hard work along the way as well.
Yeah, I also think about your, in terms of your entrepreneurial journey and where a lot of other people stop, it's not even just getting to the entrepreneur bit, it's when you're at Sovereign and go, I didn't like what that person stands, that doesn't align with my values, I'm out. A lot of other people would have just, you know, bitched and moaned and stayed in a place, and then it starts to really impact them, drags the people around them, right?
I'm really lucky, I guess. I was never a popular kid at school. You know, background, Westlake girls full of glamazons. I'm a tomboy that plays sports and works at the weekends, so I can't hang out with anyone. You know, don't have the right clothes and stuff like that. So you just sit aside from the world and you observe people's behaviour.
Mm.
You know, so I've been really fortunate in being able to, I guess, learn from watching other people and what they do and what holds them back and all of those sorts of things. And one of the things I watched when I was very young is people who were different people depending on who their boss was.
Mm.
So, you know, when they worked for me, they were completely different than when they worked for a boss that had different values.
Yeah.
And they just changed, like a chameleon. They just changed their skin. And I started to think, well, then who are you?
Yeah.
Like, what are you teaching your kids? Which one of you is really you? That's when I went, nah, just be you.
Yeah.
For the whole of your life, just be you, warts and all. It's easier. You never have to remember which version of you you were. But as a result of that, me was not call people units or think about them in that way. That was one of the things that I just wouldn't do.
Yeah.
So once you make that call, you've got to follow it up, right? But boy, do you like yourself more.
Yeah.
When you've done that. Like my mother's on my shoulder right now telling me I'm a good girl.
Yeah.
That's all right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the I think it's one of those things as you move through kind of different work experience and jobs and roles, and you see people in different industries and different positions of power and the way that they act and how they treat people and these sorts of things, that you kind of really get a sense of who you want to be as a leader. I find that experience really helps when you're sort of trying to lead people from the front as well.
It's also a very good practice for being a parent.
Oh yeah.
And vice versa. And vice versa. It's the same sort of thing. You've got to be consistent. You've got to, you know, do what you say.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to grow up a healthy human being, you've got to be there constant that they always know you.
Yeah. You definitely think a lot more about, I definitely think a lot more about those things than I did 18 months ago. That's for sure. Yeah. I just want to ask Naomi, in terms of your evolution from these three insurance companies, you know, from Sovereign to Club Life to Partners Life, what were some of the, I don't know, key learnings that you took from going from one to the other to become more successful with each one?
Yeah, so Sovereign invented a whole lot of product that New Zealand market had never seen before, and it created the IFA market in New Zealand. Because up until then, they were tied agents. There were a few hardy IFAs, a very small handful, and they were treated like dirt.
Yeah.
Because they were our tied agent. Customers didn't get a mention. And it was an old boys club. They'd meet in Wellington and they'd all basically agree who was going to do what next. There was no competition for the benefit of the customer. And Sovereign came in and just swept all of that aside. And our tied agents jumped at the chance to become independent because Sovereign didn't have a tied agency, couldn't build a tied agency with the money that, you know, as a startup. So they just went, come and be an independent for us, and probably didn't realise just how desperate the market was for that. So created the IFA market in New Zealand and brought product that no one had ever seen before, whether they were good product or not.
Mm-hmm.
In hindsight, but they were new product, right, compared to the no one had ever seen before. So what that taught me is there's a revolution with a market waiting to happen. When we built Club Life, we were successful, but we created brand new product, stuff no one had ever seen before. Standard in the industry now, but no one had ever seen it. Disability income products paid in advance, not wait 4 weeks and then wait another 4 weeks, but we'll just pay it at the end of the 4 weeks, right? We pay it in advance, so we might pay you too much because you go back to work partway through. Who cares? You've got back to work. That's a good thing, right? Yeah. Like, and it's easier to administer trauma cover, intensive care benefit, diagnostic benefits, all of those things. We invented them.
Mm.
No, nobody had ever had them before. Advisors couldn't sell them because rating houses didn't rate them because no one else had them. They could, like, it took us forever and ever and ever to go over and over and over again, but this is really good for your customer.
Yeah.
It took us a long time to teach them that. The advantage we had at Partners Life is we taught them that.
Right.
But what we learnt at Partners Life was instead of reinventing new stuff, take what is now in the market and make sure that your product is the best of everything.
Mm.
So if it's the best of this that AMP's got, the best of that Fidelity's got, just bring them all together in one product.
Yeah.
That's our invention.
Yeah.
Now brokers know that stuff. They don't have to learn something new. They don't have to worry about does someone have that bit better. They can just rely on, and it just blew in a way that we never expected it to, because we got that right, because we learned how hard it is to get advisors who are out there with six different companies all telling them lies about each other.
Yeah.
And now you're doing something they've never seen before, and it's a risk to them, right? Yeah. And they got there to their credit, but we just had underestimated how scary that would be for them.
Yeah.
We just thought it was a no-brainer.
Yeah.
It's a better thing.
Yeah. I mean, it just sounds so logical when you say it like that.
But it's interesting because the advisors are selling the product on your behalf, which is a really interesting model, because most businesses who are selling to customers, it's B2C, you can pitch directly. Whereas trying to pitch through an advisor who has, like you say, a range of products from a range of different insurance companies or whoever their providers are, is quite a difficult thing to do. Yeah.
But it's a deliberate strategy
for
two reasons. New Zealanders, don't talk about money.
No.
They don't understand money. They don't buy insurance themselves.
Mm.
So we know they need education before they can ever get to the point of buying a product. So they need to understand risk. They need to understand it's going to happen to them. They need to understand the financial impact of that risk. And then they need to understand the recommendation around the product you're saying to meet that risk. And the only way to do that is to have someone to explain it to them. So IFAs. The second thing we believed is people should have choice. If they've already got a product and they, from an underwriting perspective or a pricing perspective or features and benefits perspective, they should stay with what they've already got. That's the advice they should get, not move to us because we benefit from that. And the only way you get that advice is with an IFA, right? Independent advisor has choice. So for us, it was the best thing for the customer and the best thing for us, because advisors take all the risk of giving the advice and still not ending up with the sale.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we've got a variable cost based on the success, and we're only in the game if we're the best answer for the client.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good thing to be.
Yeah, nice.
And it forces you to be good at what you do.
Yeah.
Because they have a choice. So you can use that in your marketing. We only deal with IFA, so we have to be good enough for them to choose us for you, their client. So if we'd gone direct to customers, we would have failed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. And if we finish, Naomi, I mean, you say about your passion for life insurance. Kiwis, have that she'll be right attitude. And obviously advisors play a really important part in the education. Maybe two parts. What can we be doing better as a whole to make sure that Kiwis are better protected? And then maybe also, what would you say to those listening who haven't thought about their insurance needs?
Well, the things that you're doing, the things that Kendall Flutie is doing with Banker, with financial literacy for children, these are things that have never existed in New Zealand before. People talking about money in plain language to people. So because a lot of people, we talk about financial literacy, even those words are scary, because it's suggesting I'm illiterate, right? Like, why would I confess to that or show people that?
Yeah.
We just need to talk about money.
Yeah.
It's aspirational. We should talk about people who have lots of money and people who don't have lots of money, and how you bridge the gap between. So in my life, this is an amazing opportunity for people to learn it in a way where they're not confronted with anything, and now they feel like they're able to engage in a conversation with an advisor or a bank or anyone else on a more even, they're not scared of looking stupid anymore, right? That's what that helps with. So I think that's a major step forward. I think immigration is really interesting for New Zealand, because you don't just bring people with skills, you bring headsets. People who come from other countries where there isn't an ACC that you can pretend you can rely on, buy insurance the minute they get off the plane, right? South Africa.
I was just about to say 100%. South Africans, they love it.
Yeah. Well, they don't love it. Yeah. They believe they need it. It's a thing you do as an adult when you've got an income or debt or children or dependents. Yeah. It's a no-brainer, and you don't cancel it as the first thing that you cancel. Yeah. Now, that will rub off on New Zealand as we have more people in the country that come from countries where they recognise that you need to look after yourself, right? There's that. And I think the government's got a part to play. Now, the government played a part in telling people, you need to save your retirement. Here's KiwiSaver.
Mm.
And you need to talk to an advisor, right, to understand this. And employer, you have to make that advisor available
yep.
to these people so they understand it. But they haven't gone, not even, you should protect your income with insurance.
Yeah.
Talk to an advisor. They haven't even done that, let alone forced an employer to say, you have to make an advisor available to all your employees to talk about protecting the income that you're paying them.
Yeah.
Right? So
yeah.
it's more logical for an employer to do that. But so I think those are that's the next step in the evolution. If the government wants to improve financial literacy, do that.
Yeah.
And then more people will be protected.
Yeah.
Very nice. And last question for you, Naomi. Retirement. What does retirement look like for you?
Yeah. So I intend to have fun. So my husband and I have three parents, didn't make it to retirement. We sell a product that says, let us get you to a healthy, wealthy retirement. We can do that. We are lucky enough to arrived at this point to be able to have a healthy and wealthy retirement. We don't know how long the healthy piece will last. We're going to do what we tell people they should have the opportunity to do,
yeah, cool.
which is enjoy our retirement. So I've got some consulting work to keep my brain going, but actually we're going to play golf, go out on the boat, join the bowling club, the fishing club.
Yeah, nice.
You know, we are just going to have fun.
Yeah.
And like I said, I've got a charity job to do as well, which fulfills that philanthropic need in me as yeah. well. So we're sorted, thanks.
Yeah. And just quickly, what's the charity?
It's I Am Hope.
Yeah.
It's Mike King's baby. It's an amazing charity. And I feel humbled that he approached me to help him on the next phase of the journey.
Yeah, cool.
And what they do for kids to prevent them from becoming suicide statistics. It just speaks to, you know, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, yeah, cool. Well, Naomi, thank you very much for joining us. This has been really, really interesting. I've learned a lot about your journey, and our listeners will get a lot that they can apply to their own situation.
Thanks, guys. I've really enjoyed it.
And also, thank you, Naomi, for sponsoring us. Thank you to Partners Life. And if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe, make sure to review, like, and when will we see the mic?
Next week. Cheers.